problem with that, they have a misconceptions of the nature and they got the wrong information. The bad thing, the elephants of nowadays, their tusks are very small. Maybe they know if they are big, they can be hunted. Every outfitter must help the community around the hunting block. You can help them by building a school, making a road, help them with the water. They have to read deeply and listen to people on the ground like us who are working in that sector so that you can tell them the truth. Mimi naitwa Lilian Tamremi, natokea Tanzania. Nafanya kazi kama askari wa wanyamapori Rungwa, hifadhi ya wanyama ya Rungwa, Manyoni, Tanzania. My name is Lilian Remy. I'm from Tanzania. I'm working as a game scout in Rungwa Game Reserves, working under TAWA, Tanzania Wildlife Authority, under the Ministry of Natural Resources and Tourism.
Put down your latte and pull on your boots.
You and I and everybody listening to this owns 640 million acres.
I think he killed more deer drinking his coffee, smoking his cigarette in the pickup truck than I did spending all that time freezing my butt off.
Something that I would hope is that people realize that those are wild animals and they have savage natures.
I look forward to packing animals out. I look forward to that pain of success.
Doesn't matter where you were born. It doesn't matter where you live. I've said it before, and you know what? I'll say it again louder for the people in the back. Your present circumstance should not limit your passions.
This is Jay Scott of the Jay Scott Outdoors Podcast.
Hey, this is Ryan Callahan.
Hi, this is Jules McQueen.
Hey, everybody, Jason Carter here with Epic Outdoors.
Hey, guys, this is Tim Burnett with Solo Hunter.
You're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Hey, y'all, welcome to another episode of The Wild Initiative, brought to you as part of the Waypoint Podcast Network.
Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At Midway USA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com. The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard-issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
Y'all, I'm super excited. You may have listened to my episode with Sue Tidwell, author of Cries in the Savannah. And if you listen to that or if you've read Sue's book, you, of course, know all about my next guest, who Sue could not say enough about. I'm really glad Sue was able to introduce us. So on the call today, I have Lilian Remy all the way over from Tanzania. I think this is officially one of the longest distance podcasts I've had a chance to record. Lilian, I'm very excited to have you on. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Sam.
So Lilian, I would love it if you could just introduce my listeners to yourself a little bit. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do, but then also, how did you get introduced to this work you're doing with wildlife in Tanzania?
Well, I developed a passion to work as a wildlife ranger, a game scout, when I was a little younger. And I was in standard three. I think I was about 10 years old. My uncle was working as a wildlife commander in a zone of antipodean commander in Arusha region within Tanzania. And when he came home during the holidays, most of the time we used to chat with him, and he talked a lot of wildlife, animals, his trips to here and there within the parks, game reserves. And I find myself, I developed the passion to be part of that. So I told myself that when I finish my education, I want to study more about wildlife. I want to engage myself to maybe, if I'm not be a ranger, or I will be a tour guide. So after my secondary education, I went direct to the college. My college name is Moika Wildlife College in Kilimanjaro. And so I started to study a technician certificate there, and my journey started there.
That's fantastic. So you said it was your uncle?
Yes, my uncle.
Your uncle, and he was a wildlife commander. So what does a wildlife commander do?
It was, by the time then, its rank was zonal and poaching commander. Zonal, it contains about three regions, Kilimanjaro, Arusha, and Manyara region. So the head who maintained or supervised the whole region, his name was zonal and poaching commander.
Okay. And so so you went to school to learn about wildlife. You had this passion for wildlife growing up from the time you were 10. What then took you from getting your education to what you're doing now?
After completing my education, I got employed by the government directly to work in Rungwa Game Reserve as a game scout. Yeah, it was 2014 till today.
Okay. And so what do your duties as a game scout include? What are your responsibilities in this role?
A game scout has a lot of responsibilities, including to supervise tourism hunting, conducting anti-poaching patrols, to monitor and coordinate the ecosystem at large, to supervise the early burning of the vegetation, even to be a tour guide also in the part of the game scout. A lot in the office, we do such things such as finance also, administration sometimes.
So it sounds like, I mean, you do a little bit of everything out there. You do hunting work, you do biology, you probably tell people about the history of the region and the animals, and it sounds like you kind of do the job of about six different people in one.
Exactly. That's true.
So you talk about guiding tourism hunts on the game reserve. And I know for a lot of people in America and a lot of people in Europe, the talk about hunting in Africa is a very sensitive, touchy kind of subject. You get a lot of people that get very angry about hunting animals in Africa. And what, you know, say somebody gets on Instagram or Facebook and they see a picture of someone that's maybe done one of these hunts over in Tanzania, and they start ranting and raving and yelling about how horrible this is and how we're destroying wildlife and it's terrible to kill these beautiful animals. How would you kind of respond to someone like that?
I think the problem with that is they have a misconceptions of the nature and they got the wrong information. But if they know the reality and how the hunting is conducted, I think they will get into the point and they will accept it.
So when you say the reality of how everything's connected, mm-hmm. What would you say that reality is?
You know, a lot of people think that hunting, maybe you just go to the bush and hunt everything you see in front of you. Well, that is not true. We follow and consider the rules and regulations, and it's done in scientifically, because you can't hunt without taking the research of the number or the required quota, set the quota conducted by the researchers themselves. So the expert mention out how many animals to be hunted in a particular year. So maybe the population of wildebeest exceed the number in the given area. So the number exceeded is going better to hunt to reduce instead to bring other problems. So hunting is conducted scientifically, not just to hunt every animals. And the researchers provide they set a quota, a hunting quota every year. That helps to follow and cope with the situation.
So you said that, say, wildebeests or other animals, if they're over quota, they can cause problems. What are some of the problems that you see when these animals are over quota, when it's too populated?
Overpopulation of animals is a problem because if they overpopulated, they may lack food, enough food, and they will become weak, and they may destroy the habitat. You know, the animals are a lot and they depend on each other. So if the habitat is going to be destructed, it's also a problem.
And what is the attitude of, because I know there's probably over there, there's a lot of varying attitudes from the local communities towards these animals. What do you see generally as the attitude from the communities when it comes to these animals?
We have a problem with the animals to destroy habitats and to destroy the people's properties, farms, especially elephants or lions to eat livestock. But we just talk to them to educate them, and sometimes the government do compensate. They compensate. They compensate or to promote and to teach them how to live with them. Most of the national parks, the organ reserves, people are the ones who follow and build houses adjacent to protected area. That's the problem, the main problem. But we teach a lot of methods to help them to avoid a huge or massive encroachment, like to teach the local communities to put some barriers, maybe like to plant unpalatable species adjacent to protected areas that will not attract animals to enter into their farms or into their houses. Especially the people that can plant sisal. Sisal is an unpalatable species for animals to eat. So if maybe the elephant came and find there's no food in the adjacent of the protected area, it's much more they can go back to the protected area. Other, we teach the methods like to use chili, the pepper. They dry chili and blend it, put it in the clothes, and just to hang it around their houses or around their farm. Chili make the animals to irritate. They irritate their nose, so they go back to the park. Sometimes when the elephants they come in a big group and or in a big herd and they invade maybe the local community, they arrange themselves and use their drums to beat the drums. Elephants by nature, they hate big noises.
Really?
So yes, they hate. So they beat the drums, they make them to go back to the park.
That's interesting because, you know, over here we have grizzly bears, we have moose, we have some pretty big animals. And, you know, if one gets into a house, it can do some damage, and they definitely damage people's crops and livestock. But I can't imagine an elephant coming into my front yard. And I can't even fathom something that big, you know, like walking through my back field and just destroying everything in its path.
Yes, a lot of, we teach them method even to hang the beehives. The bees tend to make the elephant to go back to the park. So when you hang the beehives around your farm, it's one of the methods to make them to not enter into your farm.
Oh, wow. And I'm sure you guys have some pretty big, scary bees over there.
Exactly.
It's interesting because I think people over here in America and in a lot of the European countries, they have this feeling that it's like this perfect relationship between humans and animals over there. And there's, you know, this beautiful balance, and all of the local people there just love and treasure these animals. And But I mean, as we're talking, when you have an elephant walking through your backyard and you live and die by those crops that you have growing or whatever that happens to be, you would probably rather that elephant didn't be there. And I think it's amazing that you guys work with the local communities to learn to live with those animals and to deter them from their, you know, whether it's like you said, through the chili or building, planting those unpalatable plants or hanging beehives. That's, I think the beehives, I think, are my favorite idea, but,
yes, because you're going to harvest honey also. So you're going to make money through selling the honey.
Mm-hmm. That's I didn't even think about that. It has all kinds of benefits.
Yes.
So do you see a lot of issues with poaching surrounding that, as far as whether it's locals wanting the meat and so they kill the animals for that, or just eliminating the animals that are coming onto their property and killing their animals or trampling their crops?
Poaching, at the moment, I can admit it, it's reduced a little bit. We encounter the small poaching, like people entering the park to harvest honey, timber for timber, and just for the big mammals, like the poachers who poach for elephant tusks, that very reduced nowadays. Very few to encounter. Local communities for bushmeat is still there, but for the numbers, it's very reduced.
So for those listening that don't understand, how would you define bushmeat?
All right, bushmeat, the meat comes from the wild animals.
So it's pretty much any meat that someone kind of poaches from the wild animals that they're not supposed to be taking then.
Yes, it's a bush meat. It's any meat from the poacher harvested any animal from the protected area. But if it's harvested in a regulated manner, it's also a bush meat. But the one selling the villages by the poachers, that is a mistake. So they sell bush meat, but by mistakes. They made mistakes.
Okay. What's the health of the animal populations like in Tanzania? I mean, do you see lately, as the poaching has been going down, as you were saying, you know, you still have tourists coming in and hunting? And what are some of the game animals that, say, tourists are allowed to come in and hunt in Tanzania?
The animals that are not allowed or that are allowed?
Well, let's start. What animals are not allowed?
At the moment, they stopped to hunt elephants because they say the tusks nowadays are very reduced. So they banned to hunt elephants. But lately, they allow it, but make sure the tusks are really big, really big. And the bad thing, the elephants of nowadays, their tusks are reduced. Maybe they know if they can big, they can be hunted. So their tusks are very small. Naturally, they become small. So I don't see a lot of clients came. They don't hunt elephant. But in Tanzania, it's strictly prohibited to hunt a giraffe. A giraffe is our national animal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not allowed to hunt a giraffe, but other animals, it's allowed to hunt them.
So with the elephants, I think that's a really interesting point about the tusks, is if you're approved to hunt an elephant, you need to hunt one with the longer tusks.
Yes.
Which I assume means it's probably an older, more established animal, correct?
Yes, yes.
So did you see just a lot of people were coming in, maybe shooting the first elephant they saw, and a lot of younger ones were being taken, so the population wasn't renewing itself like it normally would?
I think because in previous years, the elephant poaching was very high, so its number was highly, very reduced. I think the government and international community, maybe they just set that regulation maybe to make them regain their population again.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But, you know, somebody that wants to come over for a trip, they can come over and I'm not sure what all animals are in the Tanzania area, but they could come over and hunt a Cape buffalo or a lion, a warthog,
a hart beast. Yes.
A hart beast. What are some of maybe your favorite hunt experiences that you've been on?
Oh, my favorite. I think my clients Sue and Rick in 2014 was my favorite. It was my first trip when it was my favorite because even the clients were very friendly. Mm-hmm. And I just enjoy every point. And the most excited point is Sue was my friend, become friend with me the first day. And Sue was trying to learn Swahili.
And when really? She didn't mention that.
Yes. She was trying to learn Swahili. And when she pronounced the words, I was laughing all the time because you can tell the name, to mention something here, and after 2 hours, you're going to pronounce it vice versa. make me to laugh all the time. It was very exciting. That trip was very the best for me.
So now I'm curious. Say, for example, your name. How would your name be pronounced in Swahili? Would it just be Lillian, or is there like a Swahili pronunciation of it?
No, it's just Lillian. Swahili. Okay. Swahili is Lillian. Yeah.
I might have to get you to teach me like one small little phrase or something that I can use. But
I can teach you to say thank you. Thank you very much. In Swahili, you can say asante sana.
Asante sana.
Exactly.
Okay. That much I actually know from watching The Lion King as a kid.
All right.
I didn't realize I knew that until just now, but I had no idea what it meant. But I learned that from a Disney movie, apparently.
Okay. That's great.
Asante sana.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to have to remember that for the end of the podcast. So,
fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish, it's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
So, you know, in America and Europe right now, or I should say, let me ask first, other than reducing the overpopulated animals, what are some of the benefits you see to the local communities when people come in hunting from overseas?
All right. Apart from the general benefits that the government get the revenue, collect the revenue from the hunting, I can say that, especially in Tanzania, the Ministry of Natural Resources were seated with the outfitters, the hunting outfitters, and they were planning, they were agreed to help every outfitter must help the community around the hunting block. You can help them by building a school, making a road, help them with the water, and to help them with the maybe school uniforms. So each year when you start the hunting season, you have to make sure you do a small thing, like I say, a small thing in a community and report to the ministry. That's the one, the benefit. Another benefit, a lot of local communities have been employed. Just this manual work with the hand guys, a lot of them get the employment in the outfitters' campaign. That's a huge benefit. apart from them to take the bushmeat to the family after the hunter, season finished, they took the meat to their village. So the local community also have to test their animals.
See, I think, you know, a lot of people over here, you know that, okay, somebody hunts an animal and then the local communities tend to get the meat. And that's a pretty big deal already. I mean, you know, I'm assuming except for bush meat and maybe a little bit of cattle that's being raised, there's not a ton of meat that's in the diet of some of these communities. Would that be right?
Yes, it's a great source of protein for the local community. And that's just to show them the love. It's not just the must, no, just to show love to them.
But I don't think a lot of people realize that what you're talking about, the requirement for the outfitters to provide value to the communities. I think that is huge.
Yes, a lot. It's huge, and a lot of people they don't are aware of that. So when we talk about it, most of the time we have to make them know.
That's this is the first time I've ever even heard about it, and I talk with a lot of people about hunting in Africa and the benefits, and I thought I was pretty well informed and educated about it, but I guess I'm still learning new things every day.
Exactly.
And you know, another point you bring up, employment for a lot of the local communities.
Exactly.
You know, I was talking with Sue and we were kind of talking about what's involved when it comes to setting up a mm-hmm. hunting camp. And it's not just, you know, here in North America, kind of when a lot of us go hunting, we go off by ourselves or with a friend maybe, and we take a tent and a backpack, or maybe we just take our car in and, you know, drive out and then go back to a hotel for the day. Our hunting camps, you know, even if they're really complicated, it's just a really big tent. You know, there's not really much to it. Setting up a hunting camp over there is a little bit different, right?
It's different, very, very different, and costful and well prepared, well managed. I think because it's very remote area and it has a lot of dangers, animals, predators. So that makes people to well prepared, and it's a business, so you have to satisfy your client.
Mm-hmm. So during a hunting season, how many people would you say, just an estimate, how many people would you say are involved when it comes to maybe just one hunting camp, like setting up the hunting camp, running it through the season, and then tearing it down at the end of the season?
It depends with the a type of outfitter and how many clients he received in a particular time. So I can say maybe for one client can be having a crew of about 20 members, from the cook, a tent boy, a laundry boy, the skinner, the camp manager, radio operator, drivers. So it's a lot of people.
And that's just for like one camp, one client. And in Tanzania alone, how many outfitters would you say there are?
I don't know the exact number, but there are a lot. I can't tell the number exactly for today because we have a lot of game reserves. And in each game reserve, they have their own outfitter, different outfitters. So I can't tell the exact number of the pool of outfitters.
I mean, would you say more than 10, more than 20?
I think more than 30.
More than 30. So, I mean, there's at least on a small scale, I mean, just hunting for one season is employing over 600 to 700 people.
I can say one outfitter is me because they are the same person who working for every client. I can say in one outfitter can employ up to 150 person in your season.
So, I mean, then we're talking at least, I mean, that's almost 5,000 people by the...
Exactly.
I didn't realize the scale.
Yeah, it's very big.
Boat Trader is America's largest boating marketplace with over 100,000 boats to choose from. We offer simple, comprehensive solutions for those looking to sell, find, and finance new or used boats. Visit BoatTrader.com to get started.
So what is it like? You know, it's again, you know, we have some dangerous animals out here in North America. We deal with grizzly bears, but I feel like it's a little less remote. Even when we're really remote here, you know, it's less remote than it would be being out in the bush in Tanzania. What's it like just it being out there surrounded by, you know, Sue talks about you're laying there and you're just like, you're listening to lions roaring in the middle of the night and all you have is this little piece of cloth between you and them.
I can say it's a precious moment for me. I like to be in the bush. When you have all the necessary needs, it's a great moment. It's a very nice moment. I like to hear the birds singing, the lion roars. I like it. I love it. The only creature I'm afraid of is the snake. I'm afraid of the snakes.
You and me both. My listeners have heard me say this before, I'm sure, but I'm not terrified of a lot of things. You know, there's things that I'm careful around, but snakes just scare the snot out of me. They terrify me.
Yes, I can meet a lion, but I won't be bad as much as when you saw a snake. And you remember in Africa, we have a very dangerous snakes. Especially in the Yoruba Game Reserve, we have the all dangerous snakes, the viper, black mamba, green mamba, the cobras, all a lot of types of cobras. So it's very dangerous. But we are surviving. We're enjoying the moment.
I feel like, to some extent, a lot of things in Africa, like the bees even. It's like, we've got bees, but you guys have bees. You know, we've got some venomous snakes, but you guys have a lot of venomous. It's like, man.
Exactly.
Everything wants to bite you or sting you, it seems like.
Yes, they have scorpions.
Oh, gee, scorpions. I'm not as terrified of them as snakes, because I feel like they, you know, I don't know, they're not as much of a surprise, but I still don't like the idea of them. I just really don't.
I've been bitten by a scorpion 2 times.
Oh,
yeah.
Goodness.
Yes, that's normal.
So what happens? Say you're out on a hunt and somebody gets bitten. Say, for example, Sue and Rick's hunt. Say somebody on that hunt got bitten by a venomous snake.
Oh, that's bad. God forbid.
I mean, is it pretty much, you know, they're just like, you hope for the best, like there's not much you can do, or?
Yeah, I hope the best. No one will be bitten. But I know, a lot of outfitters, they have the antidote by themselves. Most of the time they have. The outfitters, but the government, whew, as you know, we don't have. So if it's very dangerous snake, it's going to be a huge problem. But I think the outfitters, they are good to, they are well to help their clients immediately.
So, you know, so if you're lucky, they have the, I guess, the anti-venom there on the spot, but you know, on average, one of these hunts, how far away are you from a town or a hospital or a city, anything like that?
It's very far. For example, where we were with Sue and Rick, to reach the hospital, the big hospital which have the all facilities, it's about 300-500 kilometers.
It's
very far.
You're not going to be in very good shape if you get if you get bitten by a snake or Have you ever seen anyone get seriously injured on one of these hunts, or?
I only see once a lady from the village. It's called the tribe called Sukumaland, a very remote area. A lady was bitten by a black mamba, and I saw her die.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, it was a terrible moment. I don't want even to remember.
We need to talk about a different subject, because this is this is just giving me the willies. I'm like, I'm looking under my desk right now. I'm in my house and I'm looking under my desk right now. Are there any snakes around here? So, you know, again, in America and in Europe, there's a push from a lot of people to ban trophy imports. You know, be like, okay, well, you know, a lot of people over here that have probably never been to Africa and have honestly probably never stepped more than 10 feet away from a manicured front lawn, they say, okay, well, hunting in Africa is bad, so we can't tell them what to do, we can't stop it, but we can prevent people from bringing these trophies back home with them. You know, somebody hunts a lion and they want to obviously bring their lion home, or whatever that happens to be. What sort of effect do you think banning trophy hunting would have on the communities, the local communities, and just the animals in Tanzania?
That's a bad idea. And what I can say, maybe we can ask them to hear on the other side. If they are the politicians in America, or the member of the parliament, maybe they can hear the member of parliament of Tanzania, who said that the regulations and the laws that allow to hunt scientifically, so that they can know in deep the reality on the ground. Because if they decide by themselves and don't know the other side of the world, that would be very bad. I think we can tell them to listen to us on the ground and to know the reality of it, so that they can allow people to enjoy their trophy. That will be better, because even the international communities, the organizations, they allow it by the regulations. They say if this is well regulated, they can allow it. So it's better to allow people to have their trophy.
So if you could say one final thing to Americans, to any of my listeners, about hunting in Africa, if you wanted to leave them with one thing, one important thing, what would that be?
I want them to know hunting in Africa is a good thing, and it helps a lot of people to maintain their life. It supports a lot of family people. A lot of people depend on that to survive. And it's done scientifically and well managed. So they have to support it. They have to support. They have to pay for to hunt. They have to purchase our souvenirs. They have to book for safari adventures. They have to wear our jewelries, our diamond, our tanzanite, so that they can support people in Africa. And the hunting in Africa is not bad as they think. They have to read deeply and listen to people on the ground like us who are working in that sector, so that you can tell them the truth. It's a procedure, well regulated procedure, and it's done scientifically. So we want to welcome them to come and to see and to view it by themselves.
Fantastic. So if, say someone like myself was interested in taking their first trip to Africa, and after listening to this podcast, like, you know what? I want to go hunt with Lillian in Tanzania. Mm-hmm. is it possible to come out and request you as a game scout, or how would somebody go about doing that?
Normally, it's not the client who is applying for a game scout. It's normally the office who arrange certain outfitters may ask for two rangers maybe. So the office is the one who arrange. But in your special case, you have to tell your outfitters to ask in our office. I want to go with Lillian.
Can you go anywhere in Tanzania, or is there a certain area that you particularly work?
No, in my working place, in my game reserve, which is Rungwa Game Reserve.
Rungwa Game Reserve?
Yes.
Fantastic. Well, Lillian, I really appreciate you taking the time. You know, I did. It took us a little bit. We had power outages, and but I really loved this conversation with you, and I appreciate you taking the time to hop on and share with my listeners.
Thank you very much. I'm happy for me to be here. Thank you, and I'm humbled, and I appreciate it too.
All right, y'all. That'll do it for this episode of the Wild Initiative, y'all. I honestly have to say, this is probably my hands down favorite podcast I've ever recorded. And honestly, I would argue one of the most important podcasts I've ever recorded. So often we think we know what's best for other people, other communities. And it's eye-opening to talk with someone from that actual community and hear what they have to say when it comes to hunting and all of that. Really, a big thank you to Lillian for taking the time out of her day to join me. I'm pretty sure that's the farthest podcast I've ever recorded. I mean, shoot, it's amazing that we have this technology, right? And again, a big thank you to Sue for introducing me to Lillian. Make sure you check out Sue's book, Cries of the Savannah. You can hear more stories about her and Rick's adventures out in Tanzania. But y'all, make sure you head on over to iTunes or Stitcher. If you like what I'm doing, give the podcast a rating and review. It helps so much. It's like Christmas every time I get a new rating, y'all. Would love to get a 5-star review on iTunes or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to the podcast, or if they allow you to do so. But y'all, that'll do it for this week. Looking forward to next time. But until then, I hope this episode inspired you to get involved, get outdoors, and plan your initiative for the wild.
Thank you for listening to the Wild Initiative. Please take a moment to leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher. And head on over to thewildinitiative.com to get show notes, check out the blog, gear discounts, other podcasts from the Wild Initiative family, and more.
You'd think, with four of us spread out on a tiny island, that the task of tagging a whitetail would not be a big thing. But, as I've learned, no matter where I've been, whitetails can be damn tricky.
Pursuing wild game in wild places. Tune in to Hunt Stand Presents Saturdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment. Pursuing wild game in wild places. Tune in to Hunt Stand Presents Saturdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.